All right, so we're talking with Adrian Gilbert, military historian with a special focus on World War II, and we were talking about the French Foreign Legion, the kind of the mystery, the secrets of the French Foreign Legion, a group that fights for the Legion, and France decides where the Legion goes, but it's comprised entirely of foreign nationals. It was intended to be a place where France could stick troublemakers, foreign troublemakers that had come to France, and you could just, you know, make them fight, stick them out in the middle of the desert. And in the case of the French Foreign Legion, they were always on the bleeding edge of wherever the fight was. They were expected to die trying. They were completely expendable because they weren't French. Sort of a nice little jingoism there, right? It was an honor for you to die for them, was pretty much the outlook. And we're talking about how that, in a way, turned them into the toughest fighting force ever. As formidable as they are, and that may be a little bit debatable by some people's standards, it's still very interesting, and not much is known about the French Foreign Legion. The Voices of the Legion is the new book out by Adrian Gilbert. I'll get back to one of the questions about the French Foreign Legion, but since we've got him here and he's an expert on World War II, I had to ask him something else coming up next, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, along the way, talking about the French Foreign Legion, the subject of some of Adrian Gilbert's other books came up, and so I had to ask him whether or not there were any mysteries left to be solved from World War II from his historical perspective. And as to the Nazi gold, Adrian Gilbert said, "Afraid not." That you hate to be, what'd you call it, a wet blanket?
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. But so does that mean that you really don't believe in the Rommel gold, the Rommel treasure stories?
No, I'm afraid I don't. Really, I think they're just fiction. I mean, they're just a good story, really. I mean, I've never come across any documentary evidence to confirm these various stories that there's hidden gold. I mean, we all like these stories, and they're quite good fun in the sense of mystery.
Right.
But I just, you know, show me the gold.
Right.
Say.
Well, they're looking, I mean, as the story goes, right, this is based on previous guests on Coast to Coast,
yes.
The treasure is said to be of precious stones and gold and, you know, like silver and stuff, and that he was safeguarding this because he might have needed it to barter for his life, having fallen out of favor slightly, and that also he was thinking of, obviously, as he later on was part of the conspiracy to kill Hitler, that he wanted to be able to restart his life. And so he supposedly buried this in a cave off the island of Corsica in the Mediterranean.
Right.
And that they're still looking for it in Corsica. But you say no.
No, I just think it just seems so improbable. It's not the sort of thing that Rommel would have done. He was a very straight-backed sort of German officer, and I just don't see him. I don't think he would have had the time to fool around with finding treasure and then burying it and hiding it away. It's not the Rommel I know to do something like that, put it this way.
And you studied Rommel because you wrote about desert warfare and so you feel pretty confident about that.
I think so, yes. I mean, we can always be surprised, perhaps, but as I said, I haven't seen you know, dig up the gold, I would say, to the people who put forward that theory. And then you know, then I'll believe them.
Well, what about the Amber Room? Do you know the story, the mystery of the Amber Room?
Well, the room that was dismantled by the Germans and
you got it.
Berlin, yes.
This was a German, it was in Prussia, Prussia's King Friedrich or something like that. It had this gold encrusted room, 11-foot ceilings or whatever, and beautiful room, and it was dismantled and brought to Berlin. Was it put on display?
Yeah, I believe so. Yes, I mean I think it was originally in St. Petersburg.
Oh, that's what it was, right?
Yes, or near there, and then during the war, the Nazis captured the palace that the room was. It was actually amber. It was, I think it was also lots of other fine jewels, but it was made predominantly from amber, and it was dismantled, brought back to Berlin, and then I believe it may return to Russia. Is that right?
No, it's never been found again.
Oh, it's never been found. Sorry, right?
Yeah. I don't think. I mean, you're the historian, but I thought that that was one of the things that disappeared after World War II, and they keep looking because it's a damn room. I mean, that's something you could tuck under your arm, exactly. You
know? Well, I think there was, you know, just look at the way Germany was bombed and shelled and fought across during the last couple of years of the war. I think, yes, I mean, I've no doubts of its existence, but where it is, yes, that's a moot point. My suspicion would be that it was destroyed. But it's possible that somebody's hiding it somewhere. That's something that, you know, we know it was there. And so, yeah, I'm happy to go along with that story, and that somebody may have possession of it, and one day it may be miraculously revealed. But, you know, we'll wait and see.
I almost expect it to be found somewhere in somebody's basement mansion. And,
yeah,
you know, I almost kind of expect that to somebody, I just can't imagine that. Because if it gotten smashed, if the Amber Room, made of gold leaf, amber, and jewels. If it had gotten smashed, they would at least have had the remnants of it.
That's a fair point. Yes, you'd expect to be some evidence, some shattered shard somewhere.
Right.
Would be discovered.
Gone. And,
yes, but there may be, you know, credence in the idea that somebody has it in their possession.
Maybe there's some corner office in Langley, Virginia, at CIA headquarters.
Yes, maybe they all shipped it. Back to America, yes.
All right, but I want to ask you about one other thing. So, like, I've always, as long as I've got you, and you're just saying, yeah, as military historian. So, okay, so just have at this. Don't worry about being a wet blanket. Just be yourself.
Right.
Foo Fighters in World War II, the claim by American, maybe British too, but that as they got closer and closer to bombing in Germany, that they had these sightings of these glowing objects that would come up to the planes, go around the planes. Some were only 1 foot in diameter or something like that, but they were always described as orbs. And you couldn't fly around them, you couldn't chase them, they were too fast for that. But so many American pilots reported seeing them that, as I understand it, the U.S. military, the Army at the time, took great care to look into it because they thought it might be some sort of secret German weapon. Where are you with that story?
Well, it's been documented on the British side, too, that British pilots, not just during the war, but since then, have seen these, as you say, these fast glowing objects which zoom across the sky. And I must admit, I have to hold up my hands, and I have absolutely no idea what this, it could be. A strange atmospheric phenomenon, I suppose, but it's something that we don't see elsewhere. And we haven't been able to pin down exactly how this thing happens. So I just think it's one of life's mysteries, really.
Yeah, that is one of the enduring questions for me from World War II is, why did that start only after we started getting closer to being able to bomb the center of Germany? Because we had lots of bombing runs, and there were no Foo Fighters. But as we got closer and closer, these Foo Fighters started to pop up, and that makes you think, well, what was happening that only happened then?
Yeah,
why not earlier?
Maybe the reporting was more come. Maybe people, you know, I throw this as a theory, was that the pilots who witnessed this phenomenon were maybe very reluctant to reveal that, so that they perhaps were, you know, they'd been taken off duty as going mad or something, and it wasn't reported. And once somebody came forward, others followed, and the sightings then became more common in the last part of the war.
I could totally see that. That would make perfect sense. And the fact that maybe toward the end of the war, they were getting by with fewer pilots, they may have lost so many that they were less likely to take them offline if they had made a reported a mystery like that. That's a good point. But so lots of British pilots making the same claim.
Yes. And I can certainly, those the British Air Force, like its counterpart in America, certainly took it quite seriously, and there's certainly been quite a few investigations into, you know, UFOs, as they then became called, and identified flying objects, and it does remain a bit of a mystery, really, and I wish I could throw light on it, but
no, that's okay.
I can't.
But that's why I had to ask you, because I knew that you, as a if you said If you didn't know, then I know that there's something still out there not knowable about World War II.
Yes, well, there you are. That's the answer to the question. Yes, I've forgotten about it then, yeah.
The Amber Room and Foo Fighters. We'll hang those out there for now.
Sure, yes.
But you wrote a book about POWs, and so before we get back to the French Foreign Legion, let me ask you this. You know, there was stories about how they had sent – is it true that they would send – soldiers intentionally to be captured because they were to be the leaders that were in these POW camps, that they would train soldiers to go in and to help organize the resistance in POW camps? No, I'm afraid not.
That wasn't the case. Well, certainly if it was, it's another one of these well-kept secrets in the war then, because I've certainly never heard of that.
Okay.
I think that's a bit fictional.
It's kind of a popular movie or TV show idea somehow, that they would move in people that were intentionally trained for that. And I just never knew whether or not that was ever true.
Yeah. I mean, I think the sort of, because obviously a lot of people were captured, and a lot of people who were captured were particularly in the Allied Air Forces, the American and British Air Forces, were people of very high technical skills, and they were certainly capable of doing a lot of interesting things, put it this way.
Yeah. Back to the French Foreign Legion, and thank you for allowing me that detour. And don't be surprised if it happens again.
Yeah.
Where is the French Foreign Legion deployed to this day? Where are they being used? Since France has lost its colonies. They're not defending the colonial France, empire anymore. What do they do?
Yes, well, that's probably the central question that the French Foreign Legion has to ask itself these days. When they left the empire, they lost Algeria in the early 1960s. The Legion also lost its base, returned to France. It actually had never been in France.
Right.
It actually went across the Mediterranean, and its base now has bases throughout France and Corsica, mainly in the south of the country, and it's really had to find itself a new role, as it doesn't have an empire to gain or to defend. And so what it's tended to do, it's become a sort of special forces unit, which the French use as a rapid deployment force to shoot across the globe to any particularly trouble spots that the French find and to sort things out. And at the moment, French troops are in Afghanistan. The Foreign Legion, a small number of French troops are there, and they include the Legion. But the thing that's happening these days is that the French are becoming increasingly reluctant to commit to what I call the trouble spots of the world. And so in some ways, the Legion has a somewhat reduced role. But it's still in various deployments. It's in Kosovo at the moment, as well as Afghanistan. And I think it's on the Ivory Coast. There's a small detachment there. So it still has a role, and things may change. You never know what happens in the world. And there could be another big conflagration where the Legion will play a substantial part.
But how many people are left in the French Foreign Legion now?
It's round about, if I've got it right, about 10 or 11,000, about 9,000 at the moment. At its height, it was round about 35 to 40,000 at various times in its life. During the 1950s and with the war in Vietnam and in Algeria, it was well into the 30,000 mark. But it's been greatly reduced now. But it is very much an elite fighting force, as they can be very picky about who they choose to enter the Legion.
Does the country of France, do they look better on the French Foreign Legion now than they used to? I mean, it used to be kind of like the bastard child of the French army, right?
Sure, yes. I mean, for most of the Legion's existence, it's had rather, the French have a rather ambivalent attitude towards the Legion, admiring its fighting capabilities, but being slightly sort of fearful of the people in it. But I think now it's become a little more integrated into the French military system and also into French life in general. And I think the French people, look with some indulgence on the Legion these days rather than with fear. They say that on July the 14th, Bastille Day, when they have the national march past march through Paris by the French military, the Foreign Legion gets the loudest cheer.
Yeah, and the loudest cheer, they're always last, right? Because
yes.
of their very slow walk, the march they do.
That's right, yes. Yes, the Legion, one of the other distinguishing features of the Legion is its slow march. It's only 88 paces a minute compared to the more usual 120 of most military units, whether in France or indeed in other countries. And it's a sort of strange rolling march. It's quite hard to get right, apparently. And so they're always put at the end. So that they don't sort of muck up the other people who would be right. coming behind them otherwise.
It would be like a slow-moving foursome on the golf course.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So that's what they put in the back.
Hold
but, you know, they say the best to last idea, I think.
Yeah, and no wonder they get the biggest cheers, too.
Yes.
All right, so I want to, here's what I do. I want to go to phones for Adrian Gilbert coming up at the bottom of the hour. So in a few minutes, we'll give you the numbers. You can join the conversation. Questions about the French Foreign Legion, and for that matter, you know, Adrian Gilbert's kind of an expert on all things World War II anyway. But let me ask you this, just to wrap up the conversation. Let's talk about the hand.
Okay, Captain Danjou's hand.
Yeah, the hand,
yes.
Like
yes.
the hand. This is like, if there's, before when I said something about the French Foreign Legion that's like a zombie army because they all essentially, they're all dead when they join. Your old life is dead and you now belong to the Legion. Something else helps it maybe like a zombie army, and that's a worship of the dead hand.
Yes. Well, Captain Danjou was a French officer who joined the Legion, and he had his hand blown off in the Crimean War, fighting for the French against the Russians. And they made him a hand out of wood, highly polished walnut. I'm not quite sure what wood was chosen. It was a wooden hand, and it looks a bit sort of ghastly in a way, but it sort of mimics the human hand. And it just certainly does look rather ghoulish. Your idea of a zombie army is certainly true as far as their hand. But its importance was that Captain Danjou led the French detachment at the Battle of Cameroun, which we talked about a little earlier. And after the battle, the hand was recovered, and it was taken with great ceremony back to the Legion's museum, first in Algeria, but now in the south of France. And it's a very venerated relic. I mean, in fact, it's very much like the old medieval relics of the Middle Ages, and it's venerated and honored and polished and brought out on special occasions.
What do they do with the hand when they bring it out on special occasions? Are the troops expected to parade past it?
Well, they don't do that so much these days, but every legionnaire, as part of his induction into the Legion, every potential legionnaire, is taken to the Legion Museum and showed various artifacts of the Legion that have been accumulated over the years. And Captain Danjou's hand is one of the most important things that the young legionnaire is walked past, and the whole story is explained to him. And it's, I suppose, you know, if there's one thing, one key relic that the Legion has, is Captain Danjou's hand.
It's just so creepy. I realize it's just a fake hand, but it's still just really an odd thing that they do, that they go by and they look at the hand. It's
yes,
just so,
sure. Yes.
Yeah, but
creepy is the word. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's so French Foreign Legion at the same time. And they're not getting paid much, so you might as well enjoy whatever benefits you have like that. How much do they get paid to join the French Foreign Legion today? What are you making?
Well, things have changed for the good for the Legion. I mean, traditionally they were paid virtually nothing, just a few sous, as they call it. And certainly payment was particularly poor. But now they get the basic rates as the rest of the French army. So I can't give it to you exact figures, but it's quite a reasonable level of pay, and particularly if you're in the parachute regiment, which is sort of the elite of the elite in a way, you get double pay. And certainly if you're sent to to foreign parts, you get extra allowances too. So in fact, they're quite well paid these days, and particularly if you are a recruit, say from Eastern Europe, where money is in short supply, it's actually, people now are joining the Foreign Legion, as it were, for the money, whereas previously they did it for the adventure or for a chance to make a new life.
Yeah, very interesting. Can't wait to get to the questions. Want to hear where people go with this coming up with Adrian Gilbert, military historian, and your questions, your comments, either on the French Foreign Legion or if you want to shoot a question to him about World War II, he knows everything. And you can link up to his webpage through ours at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett. So Adrian Gilbert, military historian's new book is on the French Foreign Legion, the mysteries of the French Foreign Legion, explained in the Voices of the Legion. Really enjoyed the book, but I love finally understanding exactly what the French Foreign Legion is and does and how they've been nearly wiped out a couple of times. Whole battalions have been just virtually wiped out, but they fight down to the last man because they're already dead. They are dead men fighting in a way. They come into the French Foreign Legion having left their old life behind, getting a new name, a new language, and no one will ever bother them again from their old life. They'll never find them. Although it's a little different today. That's what we were learning earlier. So lining up your calls. And then also, since I mentioned it earlier, there's an interesting story from Stephen Hawking I want to get to coming up next hour. I'll tell you just now, he's saying that aliens are out there, but we should not go find them. We should give them a wide berth. More on that on the way. And you heard Beyond the Sea there. That was originally a song in French. It was kind of a big hit in French before Bobby Darin did it in English. This is as close as I could come to finding some French rock tonight. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Questions for Adrian Gilbert, military historian, author of this new book on the French Foreign Legion. We start with Kevin in Charlotte, North Carolina on Coast to Coast. Kevin?
Good evening, gentlemen. I've been a Coast to Coast listener since 1994, and this has been my favorite topic to date.
That's cool. Well, it's a select group of people that can appreciate it, but I'm glad you did.
Well, sir, that would probably be because after watching a Discovery Channel documentary in 1987, I decided to go and join the French Foreign Legion.
Shut up!
I swear I did.
Adrian, this is Kevin. Well, he was in the French Foreign Legion.
Well, hello. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, and you've been spot on every topic, including the history.
Well, I'm very relieved. Very relieved.
two things, and there was two misconceptions more than false things that I heard. One is that French citizens do join the French Foreign Legion. They actually do the opposite of what the foreigners do. In order for a French citizen to join the French Foreign Legion, which is technically illegal, they basically give them other passports, like Belgium seemed to be the popular one. But when I was in, probably 50% of the people that were in were in my training unit were French.
Adrian did say that earlier. He said that they either claim to be French-Canadian or claim to be Belgian.
I must have not been paying attention to that part. The other thing was you don't have to change your name because I chose not to. I didn't have anything to hide. And my story is a little bit different, though, because I had been in the 82nd Airborne prior to that. And the French Foreign Legion is a different beast because if I could sum it up in one word, it would be brutality. Out-and-out brutality during the training.
Talk about that, Kevin, because Adrian writes about that. But, Adrian, you said you suspected that some of the stories were exaggerated, right?
Well, so some of the more, let's say, more outrageous stories, but certainly the discipline and brutality of the Legion is well-documented, and I'd certainly believe the stories. I'd certainly be interested to hear what Kevin has to say about his experiences.
Well, my I can't really say my favorite because I took no pleasure in what I witnessed, but and that was more I caught on pretty quick. So the actual what I consider to be brutality wasn't perpetrated on myself, but because I did catch on fairly well, you know, from my previous military experience. But probably the most brutal scene I saw was these two. We were at what they call the farm. It's your first training phase, and they kind of sequestered us. It was not sequestered us one day. It was very unusual. You know, they weren't telling us anything, but it turned out that two Spanish guys had tried to escape, and somewhere down the road from the farm, they decided it was safe enough to hitchhike. Well, unfortunately for them, the person that picked them up was the base colonel, who was like an Algerian veteran, and he, you know, basically threw them in the back of his seat and brought them back to the farm. Yeah. But they paraded us out to show what happens when, you know, you escape. And what they had done is they had beaten him pretty good to where one of them was bleeding from the head, and they'd thrown him in the creek too. So, I mean, I couldn't tell, you know, how badly hurt they were, because, you know, head wounds tend to bleed a little bit. You know, they float pretty good, especially after you've been thrown in the creek. But they basically marched them around and or made them run in little tight circles with backpacks that had, instead of straps on, had chicken wire, and basically had a corporal beating the crap out of them the whole time.
Yeah,
while they expressed to us, and of course at that time my French still wasn't very good, but I got the message.
Yes. I mean, desertion is treated very harshly in the Legion, and always has been. And obviously you were witnessing one particular aspect. I mean, certainly the punishment per lot of making you run around the drill square carrying a heavy pack is one of the standard punishments adopted by the Legion.
Right. Kevin, I want to ask you a question. So did you, I'm going to assume you did, but just verify, you made it through the training?
I got my kepi. I became a Legionnaire. I did, did my kepi ceremony, did my 50-mile, two-day force march. I got my kepi. Was very proud of that. But again, being from the 82nd Airborne, where it's all about team and, you know, building you up, seeing them just bully the weakest of the bunch, I mean, to the extreme, really started getting to me. And, you know, through talking with another friend of mine that was a former British Royal Marine, we just kind of felt that I didn't want to be a part of that. I mean, you have to put it in the realization that if they had been brutalizing me like that, I'd have been absolutely terrified to leave. But the one thing, when we made our move, we waited until our second training phase, which was in the middle of the Pyrenees Mountains, and headed due south for Spain, you know, after, like...
So you deserted from the French Foreign Legion?
Yes, sir. Let's say I won't be doing any proposals under the Eiffel Tower, because like the gentleman said, you signed that contract for 5 years, and they expect you to honor it. So I won't be going on vacation to France anytime soon.
Wow. So you're a deserter for the French Foreign Legion.
I am, and I mean, there's a part of me, and you know, there's always going to be that what if, but like I said, if they had brutalized me like that, oh my God, I've been terrified. The funny thing is, you know, we saw people trying to desert. All the desertion rate or attempted desertion rate is fairly high, but they do have basically almost like bounty hunters that come out after you. And the people that, you know, once the people got away, we all kind of secretly, you know, wished them well and hoped, yeah, okay, way to go. But as soon as they got caught, it was kind of like the attitude was, man, those guys are idiots, because they went into like immediate like 30 days hard labor. And I'm talking brutal type, you know, worked from dawn till dusk. And so that was actually when we decided to escape or desert, however you want to classify it. We got away at all costs. I mean, we were determined not to get caught, and fortunately we made it.
Yeah, that sounds an interesting story. So you crossed me over across the border over the Pyrenees into Spain.
Yes, sir. Yep.
Yeah.
Very good. So Kevin, then, you looking back on it, then, what do you have to say about the difference between the soldier, the French Foreign Legion soldier in battle, versus having been a member of the 82nd before that?
Again, in battle, I can't speak for in battle, but you know, I think, you know, of course, I'm fascinated by documentaries of the French Foreign Legion now, and I think their concept, you know, is that they beat you down to build you back up. I just never saw them getting to the building you back up part, you know. And I think they run it on fear, whereas they run it, the U.S. you know, Army, especially like units like the 82nd Airborne, the Marines, are all about esprit de corps. Even though that's a Marine slogan, it's all about, you know, we are all in this together. I mean, they have the, you know, the old Legion saying, Legio Notra Patri, meaning, you know, the Legion is my home, or the Legion is my family. And they do emphasize that, but more than anything, it's all about being afraid.
Being afraid. Interesting, Kevin. Thank you for sharing that. Appreciate that. You sound very credible to me, Adrian. That's
absolutely. That sounds an interesting story, and it sort of seems to ring the right bells. It was quite interesting what Kevin was saying. Was that another American member of the Legion called Jamie Salazar, who wrote a book about his experiences in the Legion. He was in the 1980s, and he deserted in the end. But he passed all his courses, and the reason why he deserted, he was bored with his post things. He wasn't getting enough action, and he was stuck in this garrison town in the south of France. And he decided enough was enough, and he made one initial escape, was caught, and then but on a second occasion he managed to escape successfully. So right. It is one of the themes of the Foreign Legion is desertion, and people decide the 5 years is too long. The reasons people desert tend to fall under two headings. One, in the initial phases, and like Kevin is seeing the brutality of the Legion, it is very tough. And the NCOs, if you're unlucky enough to get some bad NCOs, you can have a pretty tough time. And if you don't fit in, it was like Kevin was able to fit in, but he didn't like seeing this rough justice being meted out on others. And the sort of the other second reason people desert is this other American, Jamie Salazar, was that the postings can be, if you're not in the action, can be very boring and rather deadening. And
right.
People, you know, come to Legion for a bit of excitement, not to be stuck in some garrison town somewhere.
Richard is in Concord, California, on Coast to Coast for Adrian Gilbert. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, hi, Ian.
Hi.
Adrian, just to let you know, I'm a former Marine. My father was a Marine Corps pilot, flew Corsairs in World War II. My question is, what's the connection between post-traumatic stress disorder and the rules of engagement? Because I'm concerned about our Navy SEALs, I'm concerned about the Haditha Marines, and I'm concerned about Lieutenant Bahina.
I don't know about that last thing, but go ahead, Adrian.
Yeah, I'm afraid I can only talk in general terms. I'm afraid I'm not up on the exact specifics of this, but obviously post-traumatic stress disorder is something that's only really come to the fore in recent years. But as plagued combat troops, presumably since time immemorial, and it is good that people are being treated for this condition, that people are coming forward and talking about these very negative experiences, which you know almost inevitably happening in combat, and you know too much in the past this has been brushed under the carpet. There's always been a stigma about any mental complaints that soldiers have undergone, and it's caused a lot of people great anguish. It's certainly true, you know, of all armies. Whether in France, Britain, the United States, or wherever.
Right.
And we're certainly, I mean, in Britain, a new statistic, or a chilling statistic, has come to the fore, and more ex-soldiers who are in the Falklands have committed suicide since the Falklands than were actual casualties there. There were about, 255 British servicemen were killed in the Falklands operation in the early 1980s, but a greater number since then have committed suicide as a consequence of suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think it's very important that we're aware of the problems that warfare can cause in the mental lives of its servicemen, and it's up to the armies, the air forces, whatever, to do something about that, to help people suffering from this condition.
You know, to tie both of those calls together, one could wonder whether or not one of the reasons why people are so willing to fight and die for the French Foreign Legion is because they might as well. I mean, that they want to, that they don't mind.
Yeah.
I mean, that it's so brutal that at some point they really have just given up. And if they die, they die. The dying in battle for the French Foreign Legion after being brutalized in training might actually be a kind of relief.
Yeah, yes, in a certain respect. But I think, you know, in the breast of every man there always beats hope, and you'll survive whatever encounter you're in. So I think there's always a duality here. You've got, on the one hand, as you say, you've got the sense that a lost soul, you cross the line, that your idea of the walking and fighting dead. But on the other hand, I think also there's this hope that you'll pull through the battle to fight again another day.
Mark is in Omaha, Nebraska, on Coast to Coast for an open line for Adrian Gilbert. Go ahead, Mark.
Hi, Ian. This is Mark in Omaha. I wanted to, before I ask my question real quick, just to let you know I'm a streaming listener, and last week you brought a tear to my eye. I appreciate that you spent that extra time with that Army veteran that had post-traumatic stress disorder from her attack.
Right.
I know for brevity you have to kind of push the people along, but I appreciate that you spent that extra time with her. I used to be a temporary first sergeant, and I was able to read between the lines of what happened to her. And,
yeah.
Sometimes first sergeants don't want to take the time to address the issue, and they
no.
just, and so she was probably not handled properly. But Mr. Gilbert, one of my questions is, I ended up joining the Air Force because I did 22 years because I knew I wasn't tough enough to join the other services, where my brother, who was the quarterback in football, he joined the Marines because he was tough, but I knew I was smart, so I did successful in the Air Force. But obviously there's technical jobs that that any military would need. For instance, you know, cooks, medics, mechanics, even doctors, even our Air Force doctors, they're a little bit chubby around the waist. And even before I left the Air Force, we had to start fitting up, and because we were starting to fill in for Army positions over in Iraq. We have over 5,000 Air Force troops
right.
that are doing Army jobs, so we had to get tougher and stronger. Did the French Foreign Legion kind of, did they look the other way for those technical jobs, or did they actually outsource those from the French Army?
No, they, the French Foreign Legion is like to see itself as in some ways as a family, and it doesn't farm out jobs to other specialists. It gets from its recruits, gets people with a lot of different experiences and skills, and it tries to utilise them. So yeah, I mean, obviously, as I'm sure you're aware, modern warfare is becoming increasingly technical, and it demands a lot of technical proficiency from its soldiers, sailors, and airmen. And so the Foreign Legion, first of all, you've got to go through the course, and you've got to go through, you know, the tough training we've been talking about. And then once you've qualified, fully qualified as a legionnaire, they'll have a look at you and see where you might best go. And certainly if you have, say, certain proficiency in, say, mechanics, you might go to the to work on some of the mechanized units. I should point out that the Legion is a sort of almost a mini army, and that you've got an infantry component, you've got an airborne component, you've also got an armored regiment, as well as a lot of other smaller specialist skills. So there's always there's always opportunities for the individual to be able to utilize the skills that they've learnt in civilian life before coming forward to the Legion.
So even cooks and clerks.
Yes, yes. I mean, obviously, once you've passed your training, there's that slight tendency, as you mentioned, to put a bit more around the middle. But the Legion does try to keep everybody fit, and there are constant courses, and the Legion is very keen on getting everybody running first thing in the morning. It tries to encourage people to develop their athletic and sporting abilities. So yeah, even the cooks and the clerks are expected to be soldiers first and cooks and clerks second.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for serving your country. Let's go to Henry in Sun Valley, California, on Coast to Coast for Adrian Gilbert, military historian, talking about the French Foreign Legion. Henry?
Hi, I'm curious about the Legion's activities over in Guyana with the Guyana Space Center.
Sure, yes, yes. I mean, as an old colonial power, France still has a few little outposts dotted around the world, and one of them is in Guyana, where the European Space Program is run for, and it's a pretty small little country, and you look at the map of South America, but
right.
The French think it's quite important. And a Foreign Legion detachment is permanently stationed in Guyana for defense purposes, to protect the space program and also the colony as a whole. And the Legion's very keen on it because it gives them a chance to undertake jungle training, which otherwise would be impossible. So people, Legionnaires constantly are rotated out to Guyana to go through a jungle training course, and it's certainly very rigorous from what I hear.
They provide the security for this
for the space program, yes. And just their presence there tends to deter anybody looking to cause trouble. You know, knowing that there's a Legion detachment permanently there is a good preventive measure, really.
Fascinating. Do I have one more minute? No? Okay. We'll just leave it here. But I want to get back to that. I have a question actually about Devil's Island and the French Foreign Legion. We got lots of people lined up for Adrian Gilbert. Really interesting that their first caller out of the box was Kevin, who was a former French Foreign Legion. He was a Foreign Legionnaire. He got his kepi, which is the cap, that traditional cap that we associate with the French Foreign Legion and French police officers, you know, with Inspector Clouseau and the French Foreign Legion. And if you go online, you can find out more about Adrian's book at coasttocoastam.com. More of your questions and comments, and you can also ask military history questions of Adrian Gilbert, because I did too. Coming up on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet.